That Great Business Show, Ireland's best business podcast.
ThatGreatBusinessShow.com is brought to you by De Facto Shaving Oil, the best anyone can get. Made in Ireland, sold worldwide.
Welcome to episode 119 of That Great Business Show, Ireland's best business podcast. Posting on the 23rd of December, 2022. Nolikon. Agus Foyt is Dach, I am Conall O'Moran. As always, at this time of year, we're doing things a little differently with a couple of special podcasts with some exceptional business people. On this episode, we have an entrepreneur who landed in Ireland at 19 years of age with absolutely nothing. No job, no connections, no money, but who went on to build one of the country's largest accountancy practices, employing north of 500 people. The person I refer to is Malaysian-born, but Ireland-adopted, Antoine Xavier, who I've known since he started his practice with another well-known accountant, Dave Simpson, some decades ago. The firm eventually became BDO Simpson Xavier and still thrives under the simpler BDO name. Antoine retired from Simpson Xavier quite some time ago, but he remains hugely active in business advising, particularly entrepreneurial and fast-growth owned family businesses. He's also an incredible teller of jokes, but we might just leave that for another podcast, because in the next 45 minutes, I'm looking forward to a masterclass in the do's and don'ts of business, no matter what size or sector.
De Facto Shaving Oil, the ideal gift. One bottle lasts a year and they'll think of you every day.
Antoine Xavier, welcome to That Great Business Show.
I can't believe it, Conall. I finally made it to The Great Business Show. Thank you for having me.
2.5 years you've been waiting at the door and you've finally been allowed in.
Absolutely.
Love the backstory. We're going to keep it short, but people have got to really realize you landed here 1980s. In your 19s?
In 1970s, early 70s.
Oh my God almighty. 1970s, you were 19 and you literally had sweet nothing.
Absolutely sweet nothing. I just arrived here with the shirt on my back. How I came here was my mother used to teach in a local convent, which was run by a nun from Ballincollig. Her name is Mary Carmody, I think she's since passed away. And through the nun, I came to Ireland. With nothing, the shirt on my back, and about enough to pay about 3 weeks' rent. That was the extent of it, you know. I had no bank account. I had no background in business, okay. I've never been in a bank before.
You told me your family never had a bank account.
Absolutely.
So yes, we're talking pretty basic.
Very basic stuff.
And why Ireland? It was because the nun told you Ireland's a great place.
Yes, my mother adored
1970s Ireland. Oh,
1970s.
My God.
It was a completely different country to what it is today.
Yeah.
But my mother used to adore the ground this nun walked on. And, you know, I'm a Catholic, and the Catholics, that's a minority religion in Malaysia. So on a Sunday, we would have members of the clergy in our house every so often to have dinner with us. So one day the nun asked me what I would like to do. I said, my mother couldn't afford to send me to college. I said, I'm thinking of accountancy. And she said, why not Ireland? I said, anywhere.
Did you know where Ireland was?
And not. Through her, I kind of knew where Ireland was, you know. I thought at one stage it was part of Britain, but, you know, I'd be shot for saying that.
And you land here, so you took a couple of flights, I presume, from Malaysia over here.
I flew from Malaysia to London and then London to here. Now, the cost of a flight those days was the equivalent of the price of a house in my village. It was that expensive, you know, only the very wealthy could afford to fly. And the cost of flying from London to Dublin was an astronomical figure. One way was about £250, it was, you know.
People do forget that.
Yes.
And what Michael O'Leary has done for this country.
Absolutely.
And it's incredibly brilliant. So you land here and you find out the weather is a little bit different to Malaysia.
Well, my first time landing here, I got a taxi. That was in May of...
That probably cost you as much as the flight.
Yeah, absolutely. I took a taxi and I was on my way to what's called the Malaysia Hall, the student center. And the taxi driver had the windows wound down. And he said, I said to him, can you put up the windows, please? It's very cold. And he said, it's a gorgeous day. Now, I've never heard of the word gorgeous before. That's the first time. And I remember that vividly, him using the word gorgeous, you know.
And you started from nothing, with nothing. But I do know the backstory a little bit. You go knocking on doors because you had no connections. You had no idea what you were doing.
I had absolutely no connections. And I did not know how to go about getting a job to do chartered accountancy. In the old days, when I just arrived, the system had just changed. Prior to that, you had to pay your boss to be articled. Only the very wealthy could do this. System just changed, and you know, they were starting to pay article clerks. And I went knocking door to door, and I came across this lovely gentleman in a company called Coyle & Coyle, Jasper Coyle, the late Jasper Coyle, who told me this is not the way to go about looking for a job. Get yourself a proper jacket. There's a place called the Institute of Chartered Accountants. They have a list of people who might be looking to recruit article clerks. And I went there and I saw this firm called Smith Lawler. And I rang them. I finally met Philip Smith and Pat Lawler. And they said to me, we don't have offices. We just started. I live in Priory Grove in Stillorgan, and Pat Lawler lives down in Kilmacud. You have to work in our house. You know, we only have two up and two down or three up and two down, but it'll be... our sitting room will be the office. And that's how I started.
Wow.
From very humble beginnings.
And it was, it must have been by the seat of your pants, basically, in those days as well.
Yes, absolutely the seat of my pants.
But you got your exams.
I did get my exams.
Straight through.
The pass rate was very, very low. It was once my second winter, I got very ill. You know, I was sitting December exams. I was living in a basement apartment. Those days, there's no such thing. There was a flat with no hot water. And I got meningitis and I nearly died. They gave me my last rites and everything because I was studying so hard. But I discharged myself the day before the exams and did them and got third place in Ireland.
Fair play to
so
you.
So I attribute that to meningitis, perhaps. That's what
No, well, that backstory I didn't hear before. Now, we'll skip on because there's another twist to this story. You decide to go out on your own. You're now 29. And you meet a guy called Dave Simpson,
yes.
Well known to people who played soccer because he was a very fine soccer player. He was 26 and you set up your own practice.
That's right.
Mad.
Well, we didn't know any better. both of us were ambitious. I left Smith Lawler and then I joined KPMG and I met KPMG. I met David Simpson in KPMG and then we decided... at one stage, we will set up. And so we set up Simpson Xavier in 1982.
What was that conversation? You're sitting having a cup of coffee or tea or something with Dave Simpson, and you say, we could do better than this, or?
No, I said, let's go to a Chinese restaurant. There's a restaurant called Kingsland in Dame Street. And Dave said to me, I don't like curries and chips. I said, this is different. This is the new wave of Chinese restaurants. He came down there and he really liked it. We discussed how we were going to set up.
But what was the drive?
You see, the drive for me, when you arrive here as an immigrant, okay, the determination you have to succeed is very different from somebody growing up here. You know, most immigrants will tell you the same story, whether be it Irish people in America or other immigrants who live here. Dave Simpson, his origin, his parents are from the Liberties. Accountancy used to be an old gray-suited kind of close network schoolboy kind of ties you have to have. To succeed, really. We didn't have any of that, okay? And Dave had some ties. I didn't have any of it. So we said, look, let's go and see what we do. Work hard. And if we're lucky, things will start to happen. So we started off in practice initially with just one employee. And as time went by, after 20 years, we had 550 people working for us, you know.
That's an incredible story.
It's incredible. When I look back, I have to pinch myself sometimes as to how this happened.
But there was method in that madness. You obviously did something exceptionally well or exceptionally right.
There was some method in the madness, all right, because we did not have those days what I would regard now as being considered research on what you want to do, research to market. It was based on gut feeling and experience. While we were working for KPMG, we noticed that you know, all the big firms, they were attracting the multinationals, the semi-states and the public companies. The indigenous entrepreneur, to a large extent, was neglected. They did focus on them, the very large ones, But there was nobody solely focusing on this sector. So we decided that's the sector we're going to go for. It was based on gut feeling. And that sector grew beyond recognition. As they grew, we grew with them as well. You know, that's what happened.
But it's easy to say, well, in my head, it's easy to say it because it happened.
Yes.
But like if you go down the road and you meet Mr. or Mrs. Murphy and you say, hello, I'm Antoine Xavier, Simpson Xavier. She will not know you from Adam. She will know, as was Ernst & Young, she would have known PwC. She would have known the big firms.
Yeah.
So you have to do a different pitch. What was that pitch?
First pitch was we told them about our market focus, that we were solely and absolutely focused on nothing but the indigenous entrepreneur. And they liked to hear that. And they said, our pitch is not based on our brand. We're going to work very hard to earn your trust, you know. And what we then do is we act as your trusted business advisor. Now give us a chance. Okay, we were not hesitant about looking for work and asking for work. So we had a clear market focus. That was our market focus. And I often said it would need an act of God or an act of parliament to change that market focus. Okay.
And did you have a breakthrough moment? I mean, the firm, Simpson Xavier, did you land some mega client or something?
It was some of my first, one of my largest clients when I first landed. My first client was Follens, the
okay, the publishers, they're well known.
I went to see Mr. Follens, Albert Follens, Sr., and I told him my story that I'm here. And he liked it, okay? It was quite similar to his story, okay? How he first came over here and he was trying to start a business. He identified with that and he said, I'm going to give you a chance, okay? That was a huge boost for me. Okay? The issue then was, for us, was the people. We focused on the people that we wanted to employ and the people for them to buy in to this whole idea of focusing on entrepreneurs, okay? Initially, we didn't have the research that was required, so we actually used the University of Nottingham to do the research for us, and we used to have sort of small training modules, you know, on what it meant to look after entrepreneurs.
And why University of Nottingham, or whose bright idea
because
was that?
They were the only ones between the British Isles and here who had a specialized faculty on entrepreneurship.
And who found them, or whose bright idea was that?
We found them through a contact in London. You know, so we would run these modules and most of the staff would find it very confusing. You know, professionals are not entrepreneurial by nature and to try and empathize with an entrepreneur. But we also would invite as part of the course, famous entrepreneurs of that time, people like John Teeling. We had Dennis O'Brien, a friend of mine called Bruce O'Brien, who ran an ingredients business. They would come in and talk about what it's like to be an entrepreneur and the late Patrick Rocker as well. When they talked about it, suddenly the whole thing came together. People understood the entrepreneurs. And last but not least, you know, this is to create a culture in there. We wanted to create a culture. And the culture was to empower people, and people in the office felt they were part of something that was really going to grow big here. Okay? And there was a swagger about them, you know, which was important. And the culture was driven from top to bottom, you know. At a very early stage.
And bottom to top, I'm sure. Yeah. Listen, you know enough about business. We have to take a quick break because we have to earn our crust. But we will be back with some really great insights about how to build a huge business.
De Facto Shaving Oil. The world's best shaving oil. Made in Mayo, sold worldwide.
Want to increase sales, reduce overheads, and provide customers with a better service? Then use Big Red Web, the easiest way to develop and maintain your website. It gives you powerful business reporting, digital marketing, and automatically integrates with the award-winning Big Red Cloud Accounting software. It's a game changer for SME businesses. It's so good, the government gives you a €2,500 grant towards it. Big Red Web, e-commerce made simple. BigRedCloud.com/web.
Travel? If so, make sure to make De Facto, the world's best shaving oil, your choice of travel companion. A 25 milliliter bottle of De Facto means no hassle at airports, no bulky cans to carry, and the guarantee of the world's best shave. DeFactoShave.com.
All That Great Business Show advertisers are Team GBS approved. Back them.
And I'm here on episode 119 with Antoine Xavier, co-founder of Simpson Xavier, that became BDO Simpson Xavier. And Antoine, you are now going to spend the next 30-odd minutes telling me how I can make a fat fortune. Big smile on his face.
Everybody has to start from humble beginnings. Okay? You read about all the big success stories. Everybody has to start with humble beginnings. But you have to dream big. Despite starting from humble beginnings, you have to dream big. Over time, you'll find that if you're really committed to it and you're passionate about what you're doing, and a dream starts to become a vision and the vision starts to become a reality. Most entrepreneurs you speak to will tell you almost the same thing. Okay? From my experience of dealing with entrepreneurs, two things drive them. One is risk-taking. They don't fear failure. You know, they say failure is a step to success. Risk-taking and growth. Okay? And as advisors, when I was advising them, if I came across and told the entrepreneur you couldn't do that, they were not interested. If there's an obstacle there, they expect you to climb over it, bore a hole through it, or drive a bus through it. Okay? So there has to be no fear factor. That's the first thing. Secondly, one of the important things is to have a mentor. If you don't have a board and you can't afford to have a board, to have a mentor to bounce things, it can be lonely enough to be an entrepreneur. Okay? Because the decisions you want to make and you're wondering, is this right or wrong? And you bounce it off somebody, they might change the direction slightly, but they're not going to deter you from what you want to do. Okay? And that's an important issue. Also, I would say that people talk about money all the time. You know, you got to have money to do this, money to do that. It was difficult during my time and I was trying to do it. I had great difficulty getting an overdraft of 1,000 euro. Okay? It was that difficult. But money is not the issue. It's always the people. And to have the right people with you, get them engaged, you know, get them involved. They have to have a sense of belonging and a sense of fulfillment as well. So recruiting the right people and building that team, I would say, in my view, is the most important thing.
Now, you have got, actually, I'll ask you a question that I don't know the answer to, is roughly how many businesses might you have over your lifetime advised? Are we into hundreds or are we into thousands?
In hundreds, I would say.
Okay.
You know, close enough to 1,000. Oh. And I've acted since then as chairman to a multitude of companies as well.
Well, of all of those, you must have come across guys, men, women, who were deluded. You would say to them, no, that's not going to work. They said it's going to work. But deep down, really deep down, you knew they're nuts and it won't work. And it probably didn't work.
Yeah. There are some entrepreneurs who can be deluded, particularly if things are going very, very well. They feel they cannot do any wrong. And something happens, like a big event happens, which is outside their control, okay? And they still feel they can still control the universe, so to speak. Okay? And most of them have very strong personalities, and the strong personality sometimes tends to railroad the personalities of the team that's in there. That's one of the signs that you notice immediately. You're dealing with a very difficult situation here, okay? Not every problem or issue that arises is eventually going to end up in the graveyard. It's not. Everything is solvable. You know, you start with that issue.
Do you really believe that? Everything is solvable?
I would say that almost everything is solvable, but you go in with that kind of attitude. And if you do, you'll find the solution. You always do, okay? Find the solution. Might not be the optimum solution.
But I was going to say, you have, because you're very honest and very open about some of your own attempts at entrepreneurship, and some of them have failed. So therefore, not everything was solvable, even with you.
Well, none of them actually have failed. They have moved on to a different ownership, you know, and they've moved on. And I remember in one particular case that I was an investor and I became a chairman of a company in the pizza business, Four Star Pizza, with great ambitions of growing this and taking it public, you know. And we had about 40-odd outlets at that time. Then when the global financial crisis hit, turnover took a nosedive, and then we had a scenario where the rents were not coming down, rents were very high. But the only way to solve that situation was to go into examinership, you know, which is a form of protection, really. We went into examinership and the company was rescued subsequently, you know. So it didn't quite fail.
Okay. But you were not the ultimate owner.
Subsequently, yeah. No. I made an offer to buy it, but somebody else outbid me. You know.
So what are the key things that starting out now, because we'll get onto the other stuff later on, starting out, the do's and the don'ts. You're starting off, we'll take a pizza business, for example, just because I think in my head it's easy, but obviously isn't. What should people do or not do at the very, 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 very beginning?
Important thing is the staff that you recruit. Very important. Equally as important is to listen to the customer's needs, their taste. That could vary. Those are the two things. If you have that, a good team, and also you have a good eye, a good ear for what the customer needs, I think you have it made. You
know? The staff, though, when you're hiring staff at the very beginning, they are taking a punt, basically, on you. And in reverse order, you are saying to them, we're going to be huge, we're going to be great, come on the journey with me. It's a big ask on both sides.
Huge asks, and you need a lot of commitment. But most entrepreneurs have a lot of passion. And nowadays, staff are discerning, and they will detect this passion, be it at a very early stage, and they want to be part of the journey with you. Okay, and it's a two-way street. When you recruit young people, you know, they come in with shining eyes. They also have the enthusiasm of youth and the optimism that goes with it. Okay? And equally, you have a duty of care, you know, to make sure that you give them a situation where they can derive a sense of belonging and a sense of fulfillment. And that starts with a lot of engagement, seeing you in action, you being passionate about it, okay? And people will go with the ride. There are a lot of people don't want to be entrepreneurs, but they want to be part of a success story as well.
That's been your experience, yeah?
That's been my experience as well. Yeah.
How hard did you work at the beginning?
Very hard.
Put numbers on it, please.
It was 24/7, really, you know, apart from getting time to sleep. And that's one of the things I often reflect. If I do it slightly differently, I get my priorities right. It always had to be the time I would make is for the family as they were growing up, like sports days and teachers' meetings and stuff like that. But apart from that, I put in a lot of time. And also, I believe if you work hard at anything, you make your own luck. You know, luck had a big part to play with. There was an instance where we were one of the smallest firm, if not the smallest firm, applying for an international organization called Howard International. At that time, the seventh largest firm in the world. There were six, and the big six, and then there was Howard. We were the smallest firm that applied for it, and we got it. Okay.
Why and or how?
We presented a plan, we presented a vision, but it was the passion in which we did it. Okay. And they said, they were not sure, but they used the word prematurity. Okay. That we had this prematurity about us, and they felt that we have a long way to go in the marketplace. They took a punt. We told them, take a punt with this. Okay. That was very, very important for us, you know. And it made the market recognize that these guys are serious. You know, this small firm from nothing suddenly is part of a very large firm. And then subsequently Haworth went into Chapter 11 in America. Okay. And
but not because of you guys.
No, not because of us at all. And it's to do with a preacher called Baker. You know, they got into financial difficulties, were acting for him. We then looked at that time, the big six became the big four. The next largest firm after that was BDO. And we went and made a presentation to BDO. They said, look, you have to merge with our local firm, which we did. And we became BDO Simpson Xavier. So they were like-minded. They were going after the entrepreneurial market. And they did recognize then that we were on the right track, you know.
Anything about Irish entrepreneurs that you say, oh, they really are stupid because they repeat this mistake all the time?
Yeah. Well, to be an entrepreneur, there are many a times you have to perform a high wire act, okay? Mm-hmm. You do perform it. It could be a lack of resources, could be financial issues, could be a whole host of issues. And when you do the high wire act, sometimes you fall. And we have to be there to try and be the safety net. That's why I said earlier, like everything, in my view, when I start an assignment, is solvable. The issue that most entrepreneurs fail on is there's a term called overtrading. Overtrading not in terms of money, but overtrading in terms of management resources, not having sufficient people in their team. That's where they overtrade, you know. And I've seen most companies, if you do an analysis of most companies that don't succeed, this issue of not having a strong enough management team is always the number one issue.
But if you start at three or five or seven people and you start talking about the management team, like the fella, man, woman in charge is normally the head of everything. There's no management team as such.
Rome wasn't built in a day, and I totally appreciate that. No matter what level you are, you want to have at least one member you start off with in your team, maybe two members. And that's where I feel having an outside mentor, an outside board member who's got experience as a sounding board, or to give you direction as well, I think is a very important issue, you know. And the modern entrepreneurs in Ireland are very different from the entrepreneurs of yesteryears, okay? Because they have a lot of knowledge available. They're highly educated and very, very capable people. And they think, when they're starting off, they think of the entire world as the market, as distinct from just Ireland alone, you know.
I was on episode 117, so two episodes ago, with Vincent Wall, the broadcaster, and we were reminiscing a little bit about entrepreneurship and about business. Back a few decades ago, there has been a massive shift in this country in the way that we view business and entrepreneurship.
Absolutely. I look back now, you know, there are Francis Murphy's school for office entrepreneurship studies as a course, you know. So people can study to become an entrepreneur.
But can you really?
But at least you know going into something, okay? But at the end of the day, it comes down to the personality and how the personality views himself or herself and the kind of team that they build around them. Okay? And the vision. The vision is an important issue. And vision's always, as I mentioned earlier, starts with a dream, you know. They dream big and they think big.
Antoine Xavier, I'm going to hold you there because, again, we must go for a quick break, but back in a few seconds and we will talk about where the opportunities are.
De facto shaving oil, made only from natural oils. Nothing nasty on your skin.
Want to increase sales, reduce overheads, and provide customers with a better service? Then use Big Red Web, the easiest way to develop and maintain your website. It gives you powerful business reporting, digital marketing, and automatically integrates with the award-winning Big Red Cloud Accounting software. It's a game changer for SME businesses. It's so good, the government gives you a €2,500 grant towards it. Big Red Web, e-commerce made simple. BigRedCloud.com/web.
Viscosity. When you shave, you want the highest viscosity because it helps the blade run smoother. De facto, the world's best shaving oil, has incredible viscosity. That's why De facto leaves your face, underarms, or legs nick-free. Higher viscosity makes blades last longer. De facto is the best for your skin and your pocket. DeFactoShave.com.
All that great business show advertisers are Team GBS approved. Back them.
And I'm here with Antoine Xavier, co-founder of Simpson Xavier, probably co-founder of himself as well once upon a time, Simpson Xavier, which became BDO Simpson Xavier. Antoine, we're about to talk about opportunities because, just a little bit of background again about yourself, you've mentioned your pizzas, you've been in bricks and mortar, you've been in so many businesses. So I presume as you drive around, walk around, whatever you do, you look and say there's an opportunity there. Where would you send young people in their 20s just starting out and say, you know what, that could be done better. There's a business in that.
A lot of young people have ideas better than I would have. and they're daring nowadays. Okay, and they know no fear. There's opportunities everywhere. Okay? The important thing I find when you're starting off at the very onset is not try and take on the big competitors. It's like somebody starting off playing rugby and you start taking them on in the Aviva Stadium. Somebody once told me, Find a niche that you're good at first. Establish yourself. Take on the competitors in telephone booths and mug them.
Explain that again.
Start off small, focusing on niche areas where the competition is not that good or might be weak. Take them on there and beat them there, you know?
Because, of course, young people won't know what a telephone booth is. There you go. You're showing your age about that. But is there any particular, are there any particular sectors that you say, I would absolutely keep away from that? It's just too difficult. Sometimes it's a, I remember going back again, one or two decades ago, where people used to open up boutiques. And then I learned all about boutiques. How anybody can make a living out of a boutique is still beyond me.
Property is a sector, unless you're a thorough professional, okay? Everybody likes to own bricks and mortar, but it's not as straightforward as that. The graveyard is full of a lot of people who got involved in property and development. The general public would think people in property and development make a lot of money. They don't really. I mean, given the present climate where the cost inflation is going through the roof and interest rates are going through the roof, it's very hard for a lot of house builders even to try and make a margin on trying to build houses, you know.
Does it frustrate you when you read the newspapers headlines that say, you know, that they're making fortunes and stuff like that, and you know otherwise? Yeah.
Yes, it wouldn't frustrate me, but I know that, look, reading about this, there's a lack of information. People have been misinformed, you know. Traditionally, everybody assumed developers to be people who make a lot of money. It doesn't quite work like that all the time. Okay? And commodities is another issue. Commodities, if you're involved in something that is a commodity, it is very difficult to make money unless you're an extreme specialist in it, okay? Trading in commodities or selling something that is a commodity. Okay? And a me too business, you know, where anybody can get in, no barriers to entry. Okay? Most of the barriers to entry normally revolve around regulation. And for me, the key barrier to entry is people. Recruiting the right people, you know, being able to afford to recruit the right people. I would rather go and recruit somebody who is earning more than me, but as an investment, okay, and then subsequently find that the returns are coming through because they are very good people, they have the expertise, they have the experience, but trying to sell the vision and attract them would be a challenge as well.
Where would you go to hire people now? In theory, we have full employment, mm-hmm. and certainly any of the mid-sized professional services companies that I know, they cry trying to recruit.
The information I have is people are going to Asia at the moment to recruit people. Philippines, you know, the Filipinos speak good English, and they're affable people. They come in, they integrate quite well. So Philippines is an area where people are going quite a bit to try and recruit as a country. You know, in accountancy firms, we have secondment programs and exchange programs and all that. And very often it's possible to recruit people from different parts of the world, different continents like Africa, you know, South Africa, different parts of Africa as well, who are keen to come to Europe to learn the culture, immerse themselves into it, learn a different language, see how people live and all that, and work for the experience with different type of companies.
You didn't mention Malaysia. Would you not go to Malaysia to recruit?
I didn't mention Malaysia, although during my time, I had a lot of Malaysians working in there, people from China, Australia, France, as well as South Africa. And we did move some of our people to these countries as well. The Malaysians are there, no question about it. I was at a dinner. You were there too. There were a fair number of Malaysians in this particular company, you know.
So they are available to work and should. How would you go about actually hiring Malaysians?
There are recruitment agencies in these countries, okay? Mm-hmm. But most people have affiliations. Businesses have affiliations. Through your affiliates, you try. That's the first port of call, to try and recruit these people.
10 minutes. Tell me the big don'ts in business. Do not do this, according to Antoine Xavier.
Do not think small.
That's interesting. Yeah. Some people are happy with their lifestyle business.
Yes.
And what do you feel about people who like to have a lifestyle business?
You can still have a lifestyle and think small, you know, and think big, you know. And there's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with a lifestyle business because that's what people want to do.
And when you say big, how big is big?
Any company that employs about more than 100 people is a big company.
Okay, well, certainly in Irish terms. Mm-hmm. When you started off with Dave Simpson, did you articulate, Dave, I think we could really grow huge?
We did.
Over pints or something, was it?
Yeah, in our discussions, but we were ambitious. You know, we had ambitious and we had drive. And we said, look, we want to be a big firm. We can do it in two ways, because you cannot, business is so diverse now, and you have to have so many different disciplines to try and service a business. Being small, it's very difficult. It is challenging, unless you're in a particularly niche market and say, I'm a boutique firm and I want to do only a particular thing and nothing else. We didn't want to do that. We were young and we were ambitious. And we said, we want to offer what's called a multidiscipline service. We could have done that by merging with one of the large firms and we'd be totally absorbed, but we wanted to do it by ourselves, you know.
And you said that professionals normally are not entrepreneurial. What happened to you? Because both you and Dave set up a professional services firm and were massively entrepreneurial.
We never thought we were entrepreneurial, okay? We were eager. We were eager to succeed, okay? We were ambitious. The entrepreneurial part came later. As we grew, we started seeing pockets and areas where we felt that there was a need in the market, where the competition perhaps was not that great. So we went into those pockets. Those days, for instance, corporate finance was only done by big merchant banks, and you know, none of the big four offered corporate finance. They had due diligence service, which they called transaction services. On the deal-making side, none of them did, particularly for our market, the entrepreneurial owner-managed market. Not the small ones, the medium to large ones, who are growing very, very quickly. Now, that was, we identified an area there. The other area that we went into was the entertainment sector, okay, which comprised of music, theater, and film. You know, and subsequently we developed in the sports area when Ireland first qualified for Germany in Stuttgart 88, and then you had Italia 90 and 94. We started acting for the players' pool. We started acting for the players.
But go back now one step there. You started acting for the players, but we should give a little bit of background there that Dave Simpson had a background that I mentioned
in soccer. Yes.
But there are many, many, many others who were and would wish to act for the players. How did you manage? What kind of secret sauce did you have for that one?
There's Fintan Drury at that time was advising them as well. But on the financial side, they needed advice. So we teamed up with Fintan on that one. And another, subsequently when money came into rugby, now we would act for the rugby players now. So today I would think the firm has almost 80% of rugby players in their books, as well as soccer players, both in the championships, as well as the Premier side of things.
That is pretty okay.
It is good, James.
Listen, we're going to run out of time. What if you had not been an accountant, and we understand now why you had to become an accountant because you had to pay the bills, what would you have loved to have done that you didn't have the chance to do?
One of my clients was an Israeli gentleman called Hezi Varad, his late Hezi Varad. He was in the same school as Moshe Dayan, you know, the iconic Moshe Dayan with the patch on his eye.
Patch, yeah.
He was, has he got the contract to supply helicopters to the Israeli army? And he became a fantastic entrepreneur, had huge businesses in Manhattan, property business. And then when the war broke out in Eastern Europe and there were certain parts of Asia that he couldn't get into, because he was Israeli. And as he was getting old, he didn't have kids who wanted to take over the mantle. He did approach me. He was a client, approached me and said he wanted me to be his right-hand man and to run the whole show.
So you could have been a property supremo.
Not property so much, but helicopters and stroke property.
But all good property developers have a few helicopters anyway.
Yes.
Okay? Final question that we ask all of our lovely guests is, who would Antoine Xavier hire in a heartbeat?
That's quite an intriguing question. You know, I've come across a lot of very, very nice people, excellent business people during my time. But there's one person that sticks out for me. His name is Justin Keating. And who started a company called Version One together with another chap called John Mullen. Both of them, I think, were in the ESB. They started an IT services company in 1996. And 10 years later, I became the chairman of the company, and I saw what they did. They were not so much focused on the figures that much, but they were focused absolutely on the values. And Justin drove this, okay? It was a values driven. By values, I mean basic values like honesty and integrity, no egos, you know, no blame culture in there, and commitment, you know, focus on their clients. And they really lived it. They absolutely lived this values. And they also were so focused on the staff, and they did staff surveys. And if there were issues, challenges coming up, they didn't pay lip service to it. They tackled it immediately. And I could sense that they kind of reminded me a little bit about Simpson Xavier when we first started. And I said it to them, you have something very, very special down here. And they said to me, well, I suppose you say this to all the companies that you chair. Okay. They grew. Today, they have 2,500 people working in there. And about a couple of months ago, I read in the paper, they managed to sell the company for somewhere in the region. You know, you're running into high nine-figure sums, you know, which is phenomenal.
Phenomenal. Yeah. I have to ask you, because how do you ensure within your corporate culture that there are no egos and there's no blame? How do you actually do that? You said they live it?
Yeah, it starts from the very top. Justin is also a very affable individual, you know. And when you talk to him, you'll know immediately he's a very nice person. But behind it all, there was a steely determination to succeed as well. The engagement with the people to get them all, it's like a Pied Piper to follow him. You have to have that kind of personality. One of his, just coming back to him, one of his biggest things in life was to run as many marathons as possible. Okay, and it's funny, I read a couple of books. The founder of Nike, for instance, Phil Knight, was also a runner. And the founder of Blackstone, a guy called Schwartzman, Stephen Schwartzman, was also a runner. There's a thing about runners, the solitude, the loneliness, and the ability to take in the environment and to think, you know, the determination, the discipline that goes with it, you know. And he lived it.
Antoine, did you ever run a marathon?
I never did, but I was a middle distance runner during my time.
Were you?
I was. Yeah.
I know you swim.
No, you know, I didn't record a fantastic time or anything like that.
One
but
of
I
our
was
great backers is a fellow that you probably know, Mark O'Dwyer of the Big Red Book.
Yes.
And he runs, or used to, he's just retired from ultra marathons or Ironman marathons or whatever. So yeah, obviously it's a thing. So Antoine Xavier, you made it. After 2.5 years, thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show. And that is it from That Great Business Show, episode 119. And since you've just listened to it, you know that the last 45 minutes is equal to a full year's teachings at the Smurfit Business School. So do repost on LinkedIn and send the link on WhatsApp to your besties in business, and they will love you for it. Turning to our own business, if you'd like to advertise with us, give me, Conal O'Moran, a shout on LinkedIn or on Twitter, where I am at Conal OM. We record at the Dublin South Podcast Studios, where Brian Begley is today's sound engineer. Later, Neil Horner mixes it all up in post-production. The same team also works on our second podcast, Ireland's legal podcast, that is, The Fifth Court, and we can make your podcast dreams come true. We bring podcasting to another level, we believe. All of our great business insights and tips are brought to you, as always, thanks to our sponsor, that is De Facto Shaving Oil, the world's best all-natural shaving oil. They back us, do back them. DeFactoShave.com is what to look out for online. And don't forget to buy Business Plus magazine, where we now have our regular column all about the podcast. So for me, Conal O'Moran, Míle Buíochas, for listening, agus slán tamach.